From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Kenneth Branagh talks with us about directing and starring in a new film adaptation of Hamlet. It features British and American actors, including Derek Jacobi, Kate Winslet, Julie Christie, Billy Crystal, and Jack Lemmon. We'll talk about how Branagh approached Shakespeare's most famous soliloquies and how his interpretation of Hamlet has changed since he was 20 when he first played the Danish prince. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz tells us about his two favorite reissues on Sony's new Masterworks Heritage Vocal Series. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. House Democratic Leader Richard Gephardt says Democrats may try to delay today's scheduled vote on the re-election of Newt Gingrich as Speaker. Gephardt says Democrats are exploring the possibility of a procedural motion to put off that vote until the full House Ethics Committee finishes its consideration of the ethics charges against Gingrich. Gingrich met again today with House Republican members. He apparently told them that he had attended a prayer breakfast this morning and is seeking divine guidance. More from NPR's Peter Kenyon.
The vast majority of Republicans still support Gingrich, who has admitted violating House rules and has been under attack from Democrats and a few Republicans. GOP Conference Chairman John Boehner admitted that several Republicans might not support Gingrich. Washington Representative Linda Smith is one, and Banking Committee Chairman Jim Leach is another. Smith says she's likely to support Leach as an alternative to Gingrich. She thinks Leach could get 8 or 9 votes. Leach had no immediate comment. Gingrich supporter Christopher Shays says if as few as 9 Republicans vote for another candidate, that could force a second ballot. House leaders are warning their undecided colleagues not to do anything that could help the Democrats topple Gingrich and undermine the GOP majority. Democrats say even if Gingrich is reelected, he'll begin the 105th Congress in a weakened political condition. I'm Peter Kenyon at the Capitol.
Emergency crews in California's Central Valley are working to shore up levees to prevent new flooding that would affect thousands of acres of farmland. California Governor Pete Wilson says even without further damage, the recent flooding has probably been the most destructive ever in the state. There's concern that high water in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta could contaminate Southern California's water supply. Ashland, Oregon remains without water for a 7th straight day as crews there repair water mains that were broken during this recent storm. The town's 18,000 residents are using portable toilets. A special presidential advisory committee has presented President Clinton with its report on Gulf War illness after 18 months of study. The report says the government is finally responding to the ailments that afflict Gulf War veterans, but the committee says the source of those problems is not clear. The president promised to get to the bottom of the problem, and he called for a global treaty banning chemical weapons.
As we continue to investigate Gulf War illnesses, let me again take this opportunity to urge the Congress to ratify the Chemical Weapons Convention, which would make it harder for rogue states to acquire chemical weapons in the future and protect the soldiers of the United States and our allies in the future.
The president extended the commission's mandate for another 9 months. It was to have expired today after the commission issued its final report. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 47.75 points at 6,519 in heavy trading. This is NPR. And now in NPR's business update, the stock market is following the bond market lower today. Analysts say the markets are skittish while awaiting Friday's report on December unemployment. The Nasdaq Composite Index is off about 2 points, and the S&P 500 is down about 5. The Commerce Department today reported that factory orders fell 0.4% in November. That was the first decline in 3 months. There was a downdraft on the Tokyo market today. The Nikkei average lost more than 500 points to dip below the 19,000 mark for the first time in more than a year. Nissan reportedly will offer early retirement packages to 2,500 of its North American employees. Craig Folly of member station WDET reports from Detroit.
Despite the overall success of the auto industry in 1995, Nissan is experiencing economic difficulty in its North American operations. Unlike its Japanese counterparts, Toyota and Honda, which saw increases in sales last year, Nissan sales in 1995 were down nearly 3% from 1994 levels. The Japanese automaker says planned employee buyouts will help the company cut its costs quickly, boosting the company's profit margin in the North American market. The plan is part of a larger effort to regain market share in the U.S. and downsize its North American operations. The Wall Street Journal reports the early retirement offers will be made to employees in sales, marketing, and distribution and will not affect any of the 6,000 workers at its assembly plant in Tennessee. For National Public Radio, this is Craig Folly in Detroit.
A new survey of retailers finds that Christmas sales rose just 2.4% compared to last year. Analysts are blaming a shorter-than-usual Christmas season and bad weather in the West for the lackluster retail performance. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the New Prospect Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment and the Indiana-based Lilly Endowment Incorporated for coverage of religion.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Kenneth Branagh has directed a new film adaptation of Hamlet, in which he stars as the Prince of Denmark. A companion book includes his screenplay adaptation, along with an introduction he wrote. Branagh has also directed film adaptations of Shakespeare's Henry V and Much Ado About Nothing, and he co-starred in the recent film of Othello. Branagh's Hamlet features English and American actors, Derek Jacobi as Claudius, Julie Christie, Gertrude, Kate Winslet, Ophelia, Robin Williams, Osric, Jack Lemmon, Marcellus, and Billy Crystal as a gravedigger. Here's Billy Crystal and Kenneth Branagh in a scene when Hamlet has secretly returned to Denmark. He's walking through the graveyard and doesn't realize the digger is preparing a grave for Hamlet's lover Ophelia, who has just drowned.
Whose grave's this, sirrah?
Mine, sir.
A pit of clay for to be made for such a guest as me.
I think it'd be thine indeed, for thou liest in't.
You lie out, aunt, sir, and therefore it is not yours. For my part, I do not lie in't, and yet it is mine.
Thou dost lie in't to be in't, and say 'tis thine. 'Tis for the dead, not for the quick, therefore thou liest.
'Tis a quick lie, sir. 'Twill away again from me to you.
What man dost thou dig it for?
For no man, sir.
For what woman, then?
For none neither.
Who is to be buried in't?
One that was a woman, sir, but rest her soul, she's dead.
How absolute the knave is. We must speak by the card, or equivocation will undo us. By the Lord, Horatio, these 3 years I have taken note of it. The age has grown so picked. The toe of the peasant comes so near the heel of the courtier, he galls his kibe.
For listeners who've never read Hamlet or seen a production, or who've just forgotten, tell us the basic story in, it's just, you know, plot terms.
Sure. I'm not sure, you know, that lots of people do know the story of Hamlet, to be perfectly honest, and I certainly approached this film with that in mind. Hamlet is the heir to the Danish throne. His father has died, poisoned by a serpent in his garden. This happens 1 month previous to the beginning of the play. And we meet Hamlet when his mother, Gertrude, has remarried his uncle. This is 1 month after his father's death. Hamlet is unhappy about this, bitterly angry that she should have married so quickly. He is visited by the ghost of his dead father, who tells him that he was murdered, and that he was murdered by his uncle, and that Hamlet must revenge him. So Hamlet's problem for the rest of the play is that he, the heir to the throne, has to kill the king, the reigning monarch, in order to avenge his father's death. And all the rest of what occurs in the play springs from that one central dilemma for Hamlet.
Do you feel like you've brought a new overall vision to this production of Hamlet, a different interpretation than you've seen in the past?
I think that the way we have produced our vision, I hope, is different and original. With things like Shakespeare and Hamlet in particular, I think it's hard to claim any originality. I feel as though everything's probably been done by minds much greater than mine, but we, at least in choosing, for instance, to set it in a kind of impressionistic 19th century in a much more colourful way than is perhaps usually done. Hamlet seems to be perceived as a very dark and gothic play where all the characters are sort of predisposed to be manic depressives.
That's right.
I don't believe that from reading the text. Nothing about what's said in the play gives the idea that under different circumstances, i.e. Not at a time when the king has just killed, would they be anything other than very alive and curious and bright. I think that central sort of change of thought is the, if you like, originality of our view.
This Hamlet, your production is 4 hours long, and you use the whole text and even, I think, a couple of additions. Whereas when Olivier did his movie version of Hamlet, he cut out a lot of the minor characters, a lot of the subplots, and shortened it to about half the length of your production. Why did you want to keep everything in, knowing how difficult it is to sell a movie that's 4 hours long?
My experience of playing this play in the theatre in several productions, including one that was at the full length, was that the story was easier to follow. Even if people haven't seen or even heard of Hamlet, there is a misty kind of memory of a fella in black, you know, holding a skull and being a bit depressed.
That's right.
So they've got some idea of what to expect, and yet they get intimidated by it, and they think it'll be somebody being very morose and intellectual. And of course, he's a very bright and intelligent man, but there's a story there that is very thrilling. It has basic elements that Shakespeare's contemporaries used in this genre, the revenge melodrama. If there was a film equivalent, maybe it would be the thriller. As a form, Shakespeare uses madness, revenge, suicide, the visitation of a ghost, the possibility of incest. These are all kind of crowd-pleasing, page-turning, rather, low elements, he might say. But alongside that, there's a story of many different things. A family crisis, story about miscommunication in a family with which we can all identify, I think. It would be tough if your mother remarried your uncle inside a month of your father's death. That's a tough issue. But they also are a royal family, so what they do, the impact of their personal problems is felt across a whole nation. And so you have the end of a dynasty, if you like. You see a whole world in transition, and you see the very personal problems of people who are in situations that we might find ourselves in, but they have the extra dramatic quality of being watched. They're under the microscope. They're people in positions of power whose every move is scrutinized, rather like our own political leaders today, our own royal families today. And I think that that mixture of something very epic, dealing with the fate of nations and war and politics, and something very, very familiar and intimate and domestic and personal is what makes the long version not only easier to follow, but more gripping.
We're all taught in English classes that Shakespearean tragedies are about a great person of heroic proportion who is brought down by a fatal flaw. And in Hamlet, well, the fatal flaw, some people say, oh, it's his depression, it's his indecision. I had a feeling it was like really self-absorption, you know, watching your Hamlet. I'm thinking, boy, Hamlet is so just oblivious to how he's destroying Ophelia and how he's treating her, and the way he's tearing apart his mother and how he's dealing with her remarriage. And he's even oblivious to what this is doing to his kingdom. Mm. He's self-absorbed.
Well, I think that for me, makes him very, very recognizable and human.
Very contemporary.
Very contemporary. The self-absorption of individuals this end of the century is pretty astonishing, especially post-Freud and post all the sort of psychoanalysis that we have as part of our sort of daily bread and butter. It's on television, it's in self-help books, in libraries. We're all somehow trying to find ourselves. And Hamlet is certainly doing that. In doing the long version, of course, what you get are moments of revelation, including, I think, a crucial one, which is at the end of the first half of our picture, where Hamlet goes out onto the plain in Norway and sees Fortinbras, also a young man, also a prince, also just lost his father, also got his uncle on the throne, who, as distinct from Hamlet, is happy to send off a group of 20,000 men to fight for a piece of Poland, which is simply a sort of political expedient, because he thinks it's right. Hamlet can't do that, and it puts his problems in perspective. He has to go back. He has to face his own problems. At that point, of course, Hamlet has become a murderer. The self-absorption you so rightly mentioned has also produced someone who ends up killing the prime minister, a fact which has been hushed up but makes Denmark a hotbed of scandal and intrigue and revolution. Laertes comes back, the dead father's son, to avenge him. And I think in the long version, you get a sense of Hamlet travelling to a point in his life where perhaps he is seeing a little more outwardly instead of inwardly. He is learning to forgive a little, be a little more tolerant. For me, I suppose that's what the story is about, that there's a point at which it's quite healthy to be looking at yourself, and there's a point at which it perhaps tips over into something unhelpful.
I wonder if you like the character of Hamlet, if you think of him as someone you want to, that you would identify with and admire, or somebody who is so flawed in some ways that you have real problems with him.
I do like him. I like him because he is flawed. I like him because of his fallibility. I think that his heroism, if you like, springs from his human frailty. This is a man who is often very cruel. As we mentioned before, he's brutal in his treatment of both Ophelia and Gertrude, people that he loves. But my experience of life, such as it is that people are most cruel to those that they love. One of the reasons, I suppose, in the tragic, inevitable scheme of things that Hamlet has to die is that we know that he has done some things which just, you know, in the grand scheme of things, can't be forgiven. But he has essentially tried to face up to his problems, I believe, has tried to work them out. But it's his very complexity, his contrariness, his contradictory qualities, a man who can appreciate so keenly his friendship with Horatio and the importance of friendship, who can be so loving with Ophelia on one hand and then so terrifyingly aggressive with her. This is somebody, I think, who is remarkably human and he's somebody I'd like to spend time with.
One of the many famous lines that comes from Hamlet is about being cruel to be kind. Mm. And he says this to, I forget whether it's Gertrude or Ophelia.
He says it to Gertrude.
And, you know, this is the first time I found myself wondering, is Hamlet so kind of gifted with words that he can rationalize whatever he's doing?
He, to some extent, may well be a prisoner of a very strong intellect. And when he says that to her, he has just murdered the Prime Minister, who's lying in a pool of blood in her bedroom. Their lives have changed forever from that point. The Prime Minister's been killed. The world will change.
This is Polonius.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing scene, really. Yeah, he's just... He sees this figure lurking behind the curtain and kills him, thinking it's probably going to be the king,
yeah.
But it's actually Polonius, who's got his own problems, but Hamlet wouldn't have wanted to kill him. Mm. Yeah, and he's lying there in this big pool of blood, and Gertrude and Hamlet are just like talking and trying to work things out, just kind of oblivious to the fact that there's this bleeding corpse a couple of feet away.
Well, they're having the conversation, if you like, that they should have had at the beginning of the film when... Hamlet really wants to say to her, how could you be so insensitive as to marry my uncle within 1 month of my father's death? So they need to say things that go above and beyond their sensitivity to the fact that they've just killed somebody.
Kenneth Branagh is my guest, and he has a new film adaptation of Hamlet, which he directed and stars in. We'll talk about it more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Kenneth Branagh, and we're talking about his new film adaptation of Hamlet. There are so many lines from Hamlet that are famous. Run through some of them.
Well, we have probably the most famous line in English literature, to be or not to be, that is the question. You mentioned cruel to be kind, neither a borrower nor a lender be, to thine own self be true. Alas, poor Yorick, I knew him, Horatio. I always used to think there was alas, poor Yorick, I knew him well.
Me too.
Yeah, and that was the kind of thing that I picked up as a kid off the television because there were all these cliches about Hamlet. So it's full of them. It's absolutely full of them, as Shakespeare is, but Hamlet in particular is full of quotes that have absolutely worked their way into the language.
Give me a sense of one of these quotes that is kind of really worn out when it's used as like common wisdom or a great quote out of context, but really works in context and has a genuinely interesting meaning in context.
Well, I'll tell you a funny example of it, which is to refer to a line that you mentioned earlier on, I must be cruel. The line in the text is, I must be cruel only to be kind, which colloquially becomes, you have to be cruel to be kind or whatever. I had boils on my knee when I was about 7 or 8 years old, and my mother used to squeeze them with a hot and cold poultice. But she claimed there was no other way to deal with this. I've since taken her to task about it. But that was the line she used to come up with, you know, I must be cruel to be kind, as she squeezed these boils. And I was 7 or 8 years old in Belfast. And now that line, you know, in context is, I have to say, nothing to do with squeezing boils. does express some of what you rightly mentioned is a certain kind of self-righteousness that Hamlet has from time to time, which is not a very appealing quality, but which is also part of being a human being in a very traumatic situation.
Tell me about approaching the to-be-or-not-to-be soliloquy, the most famous of all soliloquies, perhaps leading with the most famous line in all of theater. What did you think about in order to make that sound meaningful and not like, oh, yeah, those lines, I know those lines?
Well, I suppose there are lots of things to consider. I had played it in the theater many times and found it difficult. You come on sometimes. I'd seen actors do it, actually, rushing on, say the line very quickly, hoping to get this famous passage out of the way. The audience feel rather cheated then, and I used to come on one production and say it slowly, but I found that the entire audience whispered it under their breath with me, and had I stopped in the middle of the line, it would have been completed by the rest of the audience. I felt like I should have a child with a bouncing ball behind me. So I think you've got to, in film at least, you didn't have an enormous audience there. And in fact, in the way we shot it, which was with Hamlet looking into a mirror, it meant that in this vast state hall set full of mirrored doors, there was only myself and the camera operator. So that at least gave me a feeling of isolation. We couldn't have anybody else in the room because they would have been reflected. You have to try and say it as truthfully and honestly as possible. One of the things about that speech that I think sometimes gets forgotten is that Hamlet has been sent for prior to this. Sometimes the actor is so concerned with the famousness of the speech that he comes on with that in mind. And in fact, it's quite useful as an actor to come on with some sense of, hello, where is everybody? Of possibly being watched. So that quality, the slight paranoid thing, runs under the speech as well. You try and say it as truthfully as possible and as if the lines had never been said before. For me, having done it a lot before, I'd got a lot of my neuroses out of the way, and I also felt to do it in a mirror with Hamlet literally talking to himself and with the suspicion, which we as the film audience know to be true, that Claudius is actually watching him on the other side of what we find out is a two-way mirror, was something that was very helpful to me. Our atmosphere in the court was one of suspicion and spying and intrigue, hidden doors and two-way mirrors, and there was something that put a little sort of nervous thing under the speech, which was very helpful.
Can I ask you to choose one of the soliloquies from Hamlet and just talk about how you approached it in your line readings, where to breathe, what words to accent, what words to just, what to really kind of bring more to the surface, what to just kind of play down and make more subtle, how to make it sound conversational as opposed to a speech?
Well, each one's different. And in each case, before you approach the speech, you look at what's available to you in terms of printed editions of the text and whether you believe there's a consistency to the way the speech appears to have been punctuated. Often that's not the case. Some editions will give you a comma at the end of the line instead of a full stop. Or they'll give you a full stop in the middle of a line, and there'll be a different reading. Some people are very scrupulous about Shakespeare's punctuation, and some people like to be very cavalier with it. Derek Jacobi and I often disagree about this. Derek's great, feels that because nobody was there to check that you can throw it all away. And one of the things that he loves to do is to make sure that each line is said differently, particularly, I mean, for instance, specific example, when Hamlet sees Ophelia at the end of the to be or not to be soliloquy, he says, "Nymph, in thy orisons be all my sins remembered." Orisons being prayers or prayer books. Now you can say the line straight, "Nymph, in thy orisons, in your prayers be all my sins remembered." Or you can say, "Nymph, in thy orisons, your prayers are all my sins remembered." Those kind of decisions you make line by line on a soliloquy. And you often look for words that repeat themselves. I sometimes do an exercise of looking down the end line of the end word of each speech, each line, and seeing whether there is a recurring pattern there. Also, you have to work out whether there's a single idea or a single metaphor sustained all the way through the speech. So that, you know, there are endless metaphors, sometimes occupying 10, 15 lines to do with whatever, weather, the sea, mountains. Intricate metaphors about insects and images to do with how that affects politics and things. And so you kind of work it like that. And then one of the things I tried to do with this in each case was to do all of that kind of work, and especially if it's rhyming, you have to be aware of that and yet touch it lightly. It's very important to be aware of literally the sound of it. Sometimes when you are stuck interpretively, you need to go through it and just sort of as it were, taste the consonants, a lot of middle consonants and end consonants, that as soon as you hit a little more sharply to give definition to it, provides a kind of music that gives you an intuitive sense of what the meaning is. So I think you throw all of that at it, and then soliloquy to soliloquy, you try and say it as truthfully as possible in that moment, forgetting it, forgetting all of that technical preparatory work, so that the final obligation to the audience is to be as real as possible in that moment, with all technical preparation forgotten about, utterly in service to the idea of being truthful.
What do you do, like the line that you mentioned before, that Hamlet says to Ophelia about in my orisons, is that the word orisons?
In the orisons, yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't have known that means prayer.
Mm.
So don't you feel like cueing the audience, like, okay, ladies and gentlemen, that word
well,
means prayer, or just having something. There's so many words in Shakespeare that a contemporary audience, an audience who wasn't filled with scholars, wouldn't know. So well, how do you deal with those words so that there's some hint of what they mean without?
Well, in that instance, I think
defining them.
In that instance, you can be relatively simple in having her have a prayer book that she's looking at,
right,
and have Hamlet in the way he's in the orisons, you know, with some sort of gesture towards it, so that the audience will pick up or intuit, if you like,
mm-hmm,
a great deal of what's going on, even though they may not necessarily get the meaning of every line. Like, there's a line in the full version of the closet scenes, you know, the scene where he says, "For in the fatness of these pursy times," we used to have a lot of fun actually during talking, because that suddenly appeared to us like a newspaper. The Percy Times was a newspaper that ran through Elsinore. But in the fatness of these pursy times, pursy, if I recall right, you know, meaning sort of overgrown, you know, rancorous times, these corrupt times. Well, you know, in the context of that scene, you just colour the line with your own sense of what in the fatness of these pursy times. You know, the audience is going to get some sense that Hamlet's using the word pursy with some ironic colouring. And in the context of other lines that they will understand, I think it gives, if nothing else, it literally gives poetry, it gives music, it gives sounds. The sound of the word sometimes having an impact on the ear and on the senses generally, that wins an audience over, and that is a sort of treat in itself, because some of the sounds are very odd and very delicious. And even though we may not literally understand it, I think that's fair enough. There's a great deal in the play that I think, because it's a classic and has withstood 400 years of people throwing themselves at it, that resists definitiveness, there is mystery in there. And that mystery, Hamlet says to Guildenstern, "You would pluck out the heart of my mystery." No one will pluck out the heart of Hamlet, the play's mystery. But on the way, you can, if you serve, as we do in this one, the whole text up, I think that intuitively the audience respond to it in a very mysterious way. And I think that that's a magical, magical thing which we underestimate, because we so want to nail everything. Mm-hmm. What kind of Hamlet is it? What's his motivation? What does it mean? Could I have it in 3 sentences, please? It's not possible, and that's very exciting.
Kenneth Branagh directed and stars in a new film adaptation of Hamlet. He wrote the introduction to the companion book. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kenneth Branagh tells us why he cast British and American actors in his new film adaptation of Hamlet. Jack Lemmon, Billy Crystal, Robin Williams, and Charlton Heston are featured in the film. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz tells us about his 2 favorite reissues in a new vocal series. ¶¶ This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Kenneth Branagh. He directed and stars in the new film adaptation of Hamlet. His screenplay is published in book form, along with an introduction he wrote. Now, your previous film was called A Midwinter's Tale, and it was about a kind of ragtag group of actors who were totally broke. They're all utterly eccentric, and they're doing a production of Hamlet in this closed-down church in a rural area. This is a comedy. I want to just play a bit of a very funny audition scene in which the director of the play is auditioning a very pretentious actor who wants to star in the role of Hamlet. Here it is.
Hamlet isn't just Hamlet. Oh, no. No. Oh, no. No, Hamlet is me. Hamlet is Bosnia. Hamlet is this desk. Hamlet is the air. Hamlet is my grandmother. Hamlet is everything you've ever thought about. Sex, about geology.
Geology?
In a very loose sense, of course.
Can you fence?
I adore to fence. I live to fence. In a sense, I fence to live.
Kenneth Branagh, was that ever you? Were you ever doing it that much about the meaning of Hamlet?
I've been on either end of that kind of conversation, where people are trying to intellectualize their response to the play. Or I remember there was one occasion where I worked with a director who was talking to the court, who was standing around while in a production of Hamlet, Claudius and Gertrude were walking in, and he said, "And what I'd like you to do, in a strange way, what I'd like you to do is to absent yourself from yourself." And give yourself to nationhood. So a lot of heads turned around, and somebody piped up and said, "What, so you'd like us to bow?" "Yes, bow. That's good." Good.
Well, I love this actor in it because he's so much trying to prove that he owns Hamlet. And I think everybody wants to. It's such a kind of universal play. It's been done so many times over so many centuries, and everybody wants to prove, like, it's mine. I understand it better than you do.
Yeah. And there are lots of things in it that you can pick up on, words, characters. People can seize on things. This particular actor, and it goes on to talk about his extraordinary research for the role of Ham. He said, normally I've spent about 9 months in Denmark to get this right, get the feel of it, get the smell of it. And they say, well, what did you do this time? He said, well, I've got this book on the Eiffel Tower because Laertes visits Paris, and, you know, I just wanted an image in my head. Actors get very funny about this kind of stuff.
So what was it like for you the first time you did Hamlet? How old were you?
I was 20 years old, and I was at drama school. I was at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art and in London, and it was a panic-making experience because it was very alarming to see these great sort of set pieces be so close to each other. Now, that was a very cut version, about two hours, 20 minutes, but a lot of the sort of big famous bits still in, and partly because of the cuts, but mostly because this is the way it goes. They are very close to each other. You suddenly do the rogue and peasant slave soliloquy, which is an extraordinary piece of writing, and in which the actor, I suppose, is required to strike 12. You've got to give it all you've got, because there he is trying to work himself up into a state where he can revenge his father. He's trying to be like the actor he's just seen. You finish that, you come off, and you come on immediately to do To Be or Not to Be, a meditative, reflective speech, which in a sense could be taken out of the play. It doesn't advance the plot at all. Again, naked, but in a very different way, because you can't do all that ranting and raving. And it's the most famous speech ever written, probably. And I found that all these things coming so close together meant that, for me, the experience of the part to begin with was a sort of obstacle course. I used to come off in the wings and asked to know where I was going to go back on again, because just getting through it, remembering it, and as Noel Coward would say, not bumping into the furniture, was quite a lot to take on board the first time.
I imagine remembering it is pretty darned hard.
Mm. It is, and of course you don't always remember it in the right order. One of the other things Midwinter's Tale talked about was some of the famous paraphrases. When Gertrude first talks to Hamlet in the court scene, she says, "Hamlet, cast off thy knighted colour." And I was in a production where Gertrude said, "Hamlet, cast off thy coloured nightie." Then there are a whole series of characters in the play, secret characters. There's a dog in the closet scene, or at least so actors would have you believe, because the ghost says to Hamlet, "But look, Amazement on thy mother sits." So this little dog called Amazement, we believed, populates the play. Then there are classic characters, the Hamlet charwoman, Elsie Nore, lives there. Then there's
that's the name of the castle.
exactly. Somebody says they came with Marshal Stork across the plains. So Marshal Stork, another general who's in there, and also Horatio's girlfriend Felicity. At the end, Hamlet says to Horatio before, as Horatio's attempting to commit suicide, he says, "Absent thee from Felicity a while." Her second name is a while. Felicity a while, Horatio's girlfriend. The hidden meaning in Hamlet.
Well, the first time you did Hamlet, were there any hidden meanings that you saw that you thought, well, I am going to bring this to the surface and I will show Hamlet is really about?
Well, one of the things I did that I lost over various productions of playing, it was a sense that he absolutely goes mad live in front of the audience in the scene with Ophelia, in the nunnery scene. He meets this woman who has been banned from seeing him. The pair of them, it seems, love each other very much, but he feels that she's been unjust. She feels he's behaved irrationally. Anyway, in the midst of this confused, almost adolescent, you know, will you be my boyfriend? No. Will you be my girlfriend? No. Thing. He suddenly says, "Where is your father?" And she says, "At home, my lord," which is a lie because she knows that her father is watching. And I chose that moment in that very first production to do a great kind of spastic convulsion of heartbreak and madness, with eyes rolling and all sorts of nonsense, that then left me pretty much nowhere to go for the rest of the play because I was mad in the middle of the third act. So I had two acts of being completely potty. So I dropped that after a while. I still think it's quite a heartbreaking moment. I just don't think that he goes as erratically mad as I did back in whenever it was, 1980.
What did your director tell you?
The director was a very cool guy. He says, "Yeah, just go with it, man. You know, just kind of see where it takes you. You know, it's quite interesting choice."
My guest is Kenneth Branagh. He directed and stars in a new film adaptation of Hamlet. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Kenneth Branagh is my guest, and we're talking about his new film adaptation of Hamlet. Now, you cast Derek Jacobi as Claudius in your movie. Derek Jacobi once directed you as Hamlet for your company, the Renaissance Theatre Company. Did he give you any interesting insights into the play when he directed you?
He certainly did. He was very helpful in taking me through what, as I mentioned, had been such a difficult experience, which was playing Hamlet for the first time and realizing what a sort of physical obstacle course it was. And so his greatest help for me was about the pacing of the part. A classic example was in the closet scene between Gertrude and Hamlet, where, having just killed Polonius, it's a very high voltage scene and does need to be played at some kind of pitch, but you can't play it all at 100 miles an hour. It needs variety. And in that, Hamlet brings out two pictures. It's done in various ways, lockets or portraits or whatever. But anyway, he shows Gertrude a picture of his father and her new husband and says, "Look here upon this picture and on this, the counterfeit presentment of two brothers. See what a grace was seated on this brow." And he goes on to compare the two men, their abilities, their looks. And this was a passage which, previous to my work with Derek, I'd done it a million miles an hour, just as I'd done the bit before, and he encouraged me there specifically to be completely taken up in the pictures and to be rather moved and stopped short by looking at his father once again, that everything he said about him was from a deep admiration. And so it slowed the whole sequence down. Quite good for Hamlet, quite good for Gertrude, that she see Hamlet transported, that she see how genuine this is, rather than just a hectoring attack on her, that it becomes something different. You listen more carefully, and crucially for Hamlet, the actor, you get a chance to sort of catch your breath, ready for the next kind of hurdle to come in that scene when the ghost appears once again. That kind of thing throughout the play, he was very helpful at just pointing out to me that being aware looking at the text in a way with experience to know where handling it a particular way also benefited your physicality through playing the role.
Now, did he take you aside at any point during the making of Hamlet and give you any advice?
I took him aside every now and again and asked for advice. One of the things about Derek and most actors who are any good is that they have great tunnel vision when it comes to playing a role. So generous a man though he is, and interested in more than one thing though he is, his blinkers were very firmly on for Claudius, and he was very highly concentrated on that, and also highly sensitive to my position. So I think he felt it inappropriate to come and do something which, in the end, you know, is such a personal thing when you play Hamlet. It's so much an expression, so much connected with your own personality, sensibility, that in a way there's no point going and telling somebody to do it the way you'd have done it, because it just may not come out truthfully. But he did, when I asked him, offer some very good pointers about certain sequences. In the graveyard sequence, I had a difficulty with a sequence where Hamlet says, "I loved Ophelia." I always found that was difficult because he'd been so cruel to her earlier on. And yet, we'd managed, I think, through the use of some good illustrative flashbacks to actual lovemaking, and a way of supporting the relationship between Ophelia and Hamlet that really made it more important to believe, and Derek pointed this out to me, that I could invest this line, "I loved Ophelia, 40,000 brothers could not with all their quantity make up my sum," with the appropriate passion, and allow the audience to feel the awful, tragic irony of that, you know, that Hamlet can say that in the full knowledge of how badly he treated her, as guilt-ridden as he was. But the fact was, below it all, below all the contradictions of human behavior, he did love her. He was very helpful to me then.
You cast both English and American actors in Hamlet. And some of the American actors include Jack Lemmon, Billy Crystal, Robin Williams. It's an interesting mix, because I think the American actors actually do their lines a little differently, or maybe it's because I'm American. They just seem either, I don't know, slower to me, or maybe it was just they didn't have English accents. I don't know, but it's interesting to compare the two.
Yeah, I mean, as it happens, the four American actors who are in it were also playing different kinds of roles. Both Billy Crystal and Robin Crystal, Billy Crystal and Robin Williams were playing parts that were written in prose rather than in verse. So it called for a more conversational style, if you like. And Billy Crystal's character, the first gravedigger, being a lower life character. Shakespeare gives him a different kind of vocabulary anyway. It's important that the difference exists. That's what I wanted to suggest, that Shakespeare's for everybody, and there ain't a right way of doing it, however marvellous it may be to hear what one thinks of as the classic Shakespearean actors do this kind of stuff. I think the richer the mix, the better for me.
You cast Charlton Heston as the head of a group of itinerant actors who come to perform at the palace. Now, Charlton Heston directed and starred in a version of Antony and Cleopatra, and also starred in a movie version of Julius Caesar. And I'm wondering what you thought of his movie versions of Shakespeare.
I admire them very much. I think that Charlton Heston has incredible passion for this man's writing, and very, very strong ideas.
I think he's really good in the movie.
Yeah.
It must have been almost entertaining in a way to work with him, because Charlton Heston just kind of symbolizes big American movies, whether it's Shakespeare or The Ten Commandments or Ben-Hur. It's epic.
Mm. Well, he is an epic figure. He's a legendary figure, and that's in a way why he, I think, does such a wonderful job in the play, aside from the skill and the talent he brings to the lines. To have someone of such charisma and magnetism come to a part that needed to be played by somebody just like that, in order to justify what the play does. Hamlet sees this man perform, having indicated in the lines before that he's a big, long-time fan of his. And as a result of the way this man transports Hamlet back to a time when people did revenge their fathers for dastardly deeds, Hamlet gets the idea to put on a play and try and prove Claudius's guilt that way. So in a way, the player king, the part Charlton Heston plays, ought to be the best performance in the play. He's supposed to be the best actor in the play.
That's right.
And Heston comes to it with terrific passion and that great Mount Rushmore presence. And there's no one quite like him.
What are some of the things you feel you've learned now about bringing Shakespeare to the screen?
I think, for me, Several things. First of all, the approach to Shakespeare is entirely individual, I think. I try and remind myself, and feel it strongly anyway, that there is no set way to do this. And you can see in the recent Romeo and Juliet, which was so radically different from previous versions in the way the Pacino film Looking for Richard dealt with Shakespeare, all with American actors doing splendid work. It seemed to me that underlined the fact that it belongs to everybody and there's no reason why American actors can't do it. It can be done in many, many different ways, and I feel you have to assume that the audience are not familiar with the story. I mean, people say, oh, I haven't read Hamlet for years. I think, well, why should you read Hamlet? I don't sit and read Shakespeare's plays. It's not something we tend to do. It's reading plays for pleasure is a relatively unusual thing to do, and there are many more things we want to do with our time, or our reading time, you know. It's approaching the play as if people had never seen it before, telling the story as honestly as possible, finding a setting, finding an interpretation that releases as much of the play as possible, working on the assumption, which I feel that Shakespeare is so much cleverer, has so many better ideas than you will ever have. If you can somehow find a setting that releases as much of his work as possible, the narrower it is, the more specific it is, the less of the play you get. And that mystery, the mysterious quality I was talking about, the quality that comes through this material being written by a great poet, that thing that gets under your skin, that moves you, and you're not quite sure why, it gets those little hairs on the back of the neck tingling, that's what I want to tap into. And it's finding something that has a strong interpretation in terms of its setting, its costume, its looks, but which releases the play, and in the end, not just surprises the audience, but surprises me and the other actors as we do it.
You know, a lot of actors say that what they really want is to play Hamlet, or what they really want is to star in Macbeth. Their ambition, although they're doing sitcoms or soap operas or action films, their ambition is really to do Shakespeare one day. You actually keep doing Shakespeare. I mean, you've been in some contemporary films, and I'm sure we'll be in more, but you keep going back to Shakespeare, and no one is forcing you to do this, and you're not doing it just to prove yourself, because you've already proven yourself. So I have to assume that there's just a deep feeling that a genuine deep feeling that you have for Shakespeare, and I'd like to know what that is, what keeps bringing you back.
Well, it is a deep feeling. It's a response to the words. It's like great music, you come back to it and you hear different things. You know, you can respond to the same play differently from year to year, from month to month. There's so much to be recognized in Shakespeare, in human relationships, and indeed in sort of, you know, world events, politics, war, all of the things that still pretty much preoccupy the human race are all in these plays. And to go back to them and to, as I say, the music analogy is the one that makes sense to me. Because all I can say is that when you go back to a play you've known for a while, you feel it more deeply. You feel the response more deeply. I think that's true of anyone. It doesn't make you a more special person, because I think people can have very strong responses to these plays on first seeing them, perhaps their strongest response. But it continues, as someone once said to me, like a good dog, to give you much more than you'll ever possibly give it. It gives you kind of an unconditional feeling. It just it gives you something. It's poetry, and it nourishes the soul.
Kenneth Branagh, a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for
talking
with us. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Kenneth Branagh directed and stars in the new film adaptation of Hamlet. The screenplay is published in book form, along with an introduction by Branagh. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz on a new vocal reissue series. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Small record labels have been reissuing historic recordings on CD for years. Now the major record companies have started doing the same thing in a more systematic way with their own archives. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is delighted.
Given the economic pressures on the major classical record labels, it's good news that some companies are now reactivating their old catalogs. Deutsche Grammophon series The Originals gives us new CDs of classic LPs by such notable artists as Sviatoslav Richter, Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, and Pierre Boulez, with the original album covers nostalgically reproduced on the CD. Sony's Masterworks Heritage series goes even further back into the catalog of Columbia Records, which started recording opera in 1902. A two-CD set called the Grand Opera Series includes the first opera recordings ever made in this country, with a charming 50-page reproduction of the original brochure. Some of the singers are obscure, but others like Ernestine Schumann-Heink, Edward Dureski, and Antonio Scotti are legendary. Here's Scotti in the Toreador song from Carmen on a 94-year-old recording that begins with the identification of the aria, the singer, and the label.
The Toreador song from Carmen by Scotti, Columbia Records.
I particularly cherish two of the vocal reissues in this Masterworks Heritage series. They're so ravishingly beautiful, I've been waiting to play them on the air for years. One of the most sensuous song cycles ever written is Berlioz's Nuit d'été, Summer Nights, a setting of six intense and haunting poems by Théophile Gautier. The recording I always go back to is the one by the American soprano Eleanor Stieber, a singer of great glamour and charm, equally at home in French music, Mozart, Puccini, and in the fervent sacred arias by Bach and others that are also included on this new disc. Stieber transcends the mere beauty of her sound with her wholehearted emotional involvement. As in the exquisite opening of the fourth song from Nuit d'été, Absence. Reviens, reviens, ma bien-aimée. Come back, my beloved. This 1954 recording is conducted by Dimitri Metropoulos shortly after he and Stieber performed the New York premiere of the entire work. Here's another treat that's now finally available on CD. Bidu Sayão was Brazil's most remarkable opera singer. One of her best roles was the peasant bride Zerlina in Don Giovanni, who was so sly and witty, you wonder if it's she or Don Giovanni who's doing the seducing. Sayão's most famous recording is probably her countryman Heitor Villa-Lobos's Bachianas Brasileiras No. 5. The title means something like Brazilian Bach stuff, where Bach counterpoint and instrumentation gets injected with the lush and colorful atmosphere of Brazil. This 1945 recording, conducted by Villa-Lobos himself, is the very first recording of this piece, made even before the composer added its final section. Sayão is accompanied by 8 cellos, led by Leonard Rose, and a double bass. Villa-Lobos had originally planned the solo part for violin, but Sayão talked him into trying it with her voice. In one astonishing section, what you hear sounds like a violin, but it's actually Sayão herself humming, as the score indicates, with her lips closed. The delightful packaging has lots of pictures and information, everything except what you want most, the words to the songs and arias. Still, it's important that the big record companies are beginning to realize what treasures they have in their own back catalogs.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed albums by Eleanor Stieber and Bidu Sayão. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from The People vs. Larry Flint, a Milos Forman film now at theaters everywhere. This is NPR, National Public Radio.